Shabbat Shalom. What's up? We often tend to interpret the immediate circumstances around us as though it was the entire story, and it's like us to do that, but a snapshot doesn't tell the whole story. This Shabbat's parasha Vayeshev means, and he dwelt. It covers Genesis chapters 37 through 40. Jacob is now living, that's why the name of Vayeshev, he's dwelling in Canaan. At this point, our attention turns to Joseph, Rachel's firstborn, and he's now 17 years old. Rachel, of course, had been Jacob's favored wife, and now that she was gone, it's no surprise that Jacob lavishes his affection and his attention on Joseph, their son, together. But this favoritism doesn't sit well with Joseph's brothers. We're told they harbored bitter resentment towards him. And the situation is compounded by a bad report that Joseph brings back to his father about his brother's apparently substandard work. And it gets worse. Jacob gives Joseph an extravagant robe. Some Bible versions translate it a full-length robe, others a multicolored robe. And you might be interested to know that both archaeological and documentary evidence from that time suggests that tribal heads would wear these extravagant robes as a sign of their leadership. And so we should probably understand Jacob giving Joseph that extraordinary robe to mean that Joseph was his choice to become the next leader of the family. And that might also help explain his brother's antagonism. Oh, but it gets worse. Joseph has two amazing dreams. Now, the dreams are great, but in these dreams, it appears he is to be exalted over his brothers and even over his father. And then he tells the whole family about it. That probably wasn't smart. Jacob rebukes Joseph, but at the same time, Moses tells us that Jacob kind of kept that in mind. But now the brothers are livid. A short time later, when Joseph is sent to, once again, to check on his brothers, they see him approaching at a distance, and they plot together to kill him. Now, Reuben is concerned, and he wants to save Joseph's life, so he comes up with a plan B. He suggests instead they throw him in a pit, and he figures later on he'll come and rescue him. And the others go along with the idea. Later, while sitting down to eat, and I'm sure it was at quite a distance because it's hard to enjoy a meal when somebody's crying for help, so I'm sure they're quite a ways away, but while they're sitting down to eat, the brothers see an Ishmaelite caravan going by, and they come up with a brainstorm. Hey, why kill him? Why not just sell him as a slave instead? It beats murder, and they'll have a few shekels to show for it. But remember, they're a long way away from where Joseph is, because apparently at some point while they had gone off to eat, a group of Midianite traders, and the Midianites are a whole separate group than Ishmaelites, believe me, a group of Midianite traders had already found Joseph, and they took him, and they sold him to the Ishmaelite traders. So Reuben returns to the pit only to find out that Joseph is gone. Oh boy. Well, the brothers concoct a lie to tell their father. Now, they had confiscated Joseph's robe, and what they did was they took the robe, they dipped it in the blood of an animal that they had slaughtered for the purpose, and they tore it, and then they brought that robe to their father. When Jacob sees the torn and bloodied robe, he is made to believe that Joseph, his beloved son, is dead. He's devastated. And, you know, from that day forward, Jacob is a broken man. And you can just see it in the text. What a despicable lie the brothers told. Meanwhile, Joseph has been taken to Egypt and sold as a slave to Potiphar, who is the captain of Pharaoh's guard, his personal guard. Now, eventually we're going to see that this was all part of God's strategic plan. But for now, our hearts grieve for Joseph, whose circumstances, particularly at the moment, seem especially bitter. At this point, our attention now is turned once again to Canaan. Judah has taken a Canaanite wife, who bore him three sons, Onan, and Shelah. And what we find out is that Judah's wife later dies, leaving him a widower. And some years later, Judah arranges a marriage between his firstborn, and a young woman named Tamar. Adonai regarded as an evil person and took his life. Judah then directs Onan, the next brother in line, to be married to Tamar. But because this was part of levirate marriage and it's part of what the Torah prescribed. But this is interesting because the events in this narrative predate the giving of the Torah at Sinai by over 400 years. So apparently levirate marriage was already something that was in place. Onan, however, he does take Tamar as a wife, but he refuses to raise up children by her because they would not be counted as his own, but his deceased brothers. So he doesn't allow her to get pregnant. And on account of this callous disregard, God takes his life too. Now Judah is faced with the prospect of having to give his only surviving son, Shelah, to Tamar, and wonders if Shelah will end up dying too. So Judah delays doing anything about the situation. And after a few years of waiting, Tamar figures out that this marriage isn't going to happen. So she takes matters into her own hands. And that doesn't usually go well. Disguising herself as a prostitute, she lures Judah into having relations with her. And then when 3 months have passed and Tamar is discovered to be pregnant, Judah presumes that she's committed adultery and is about to have her put to death when she reveals an inconvenient truth that he himself is the father. He admits his own guilt in not having fulfilled his promise to give Tamar to Shelah. He never has relations with her again, and she gives birth to twins, Perez and Zerah. Why would Moses, in writing the Torah, dedicate the better part of a chapter to what is such a distasteful series of events? Well, part of the answer, as we will find out in Genesis chapter 49 when we get there, it is Judah who will inherit that patriarchal blessing from Jacob, and he will have preeminence among the sons of Jacob. And it is through Judah that we trace the lineage of the Messiah. Still, it's a very unpleasant digression here. It was not going to be through Onan, or Shelah that the line continues, but through Perez, Judah's son by Tamar. Now, it may be scandalous, but God chooses very ordinary, very flawed human beings to accomplish his purposes and turns otherwise adverse circumstances to his glory. So if you've made grievous mistakes in your life, and so many of us have, if you've made mistakes in your life, you need to know that God can redeem those things and turn your life for good and to his glory. Well, the narrative cuts back to Joseph, who's now a slave in Egypt. His work for Potiphar was exemplary. God was with Joseph, and that's the most important fact that we need to take with us here. God was with Joseph and prospered everything he did. Potiphar recognizes that something extraordinary is in this young man, and he puts Joseph in charge of his entire household. But at one point, Potiphar's wife gets the hots for Joseph. She begins attempting to seduce him, and he repeatedly refuses. He's a godly young man. He was not going to offend the living God. Day after day, she persisted, to no avail. And in anger, finally, she turned on Joseph, lying to Potiphar that Joseph had tried to rape her. Potiphar was furious, but rather than having Joseph put to death, instead had him consigned to prison. Poor Joseph, innocent of any wrongdoing, yet betrayed by his brothers, sold into slavery, and now falsely accused and in prison. But God was with him even in his imprisonment and gave him favor with the chief jailer Sometime later, Pharaoh's chief cupbaker and chief baker, cupbearer and baker, they're put in prison. Joseph is given charge over the baker and the cupbearer. And one day, he sees that they look particularly dejected. They relate to him these strange dreams they each had the night before. Joseph interprets their dreams. The cupbearer will be restored to office in 3 days, but the baker will be hanged in 3 days. He beseeched the cupbearer to please remember him when those things came to pass and to please petition Pharaoh for Joseph's release. Well, 3 days later, the events come to pass just as Joseph interpreted. The baker was hanged, the cupbearer restored to his office, but the chief cupbearer completely forgot about Joseph. And thus he was to languish in prison for another 2 years. How would you feel in those circumstances? Would you feel abandoned? Perhaps you would, but you'd be wrong. God was with Joseph. Those years of adversity shaped Joseph's character for the better. He learned humility. And you know, hardship can work patience in us. Adversity can teach us to rely that much more on God in every situation. Knowing what we know about Joseph's life, we should not be hasty to interpret our immediate circumstances as either proving God's favor or disfavor. Remember, it's a snapshot. It's not the whole motion picture. We don't know the end of a matter from the beginning. Let me conclude with this. The Haftarah for Vayeshev is Amos, chapter 2, verse 6 through chapter 3, verse 8. And listen to how the opening verse goes. Thus says Adonai, for 3 transgressions of Israel and for 4, I will not revoke its punishment, because they sell the righteous for money and the needy for a pair of sandals. The rabbis understood plainly that Joseph was innocent of any wrongdoing, yet his brothers, envious of him and hating him, intended to pawn him off to the Ishmaelites for a bag of silver. And they are considered to have gone through with it. They bear that guilt, even though the Midianites got to him first. Maybe Rabbi Paul had Joseph in mind when he wrote, God causes all things to work together for good for those who love God. Joseph loved God. You don't have to like hardship, but you can still cling to God in the midst of it and be better for it. Trust that he is at work in you, desiring to mold your character in preparation for an eternity to be spent in his glorious presence. Joseph's humiliation and his suffering, despite his innocence, led some ancient rabbis to describe the Messiah as Ben Yosef. Messiah would also be innocent of any wrongdoing. Messiah would also be despised by his brothers and sold out for a sum of money. And just as Joseph's brothers thought his disappearance would be the end of the story, but were wrong, so Messiah Yeshua's death was not to be the end of the story. More on that, God willing, next Shabbat as we follow Joseph's life.